Coming up on Tech Nation, Dr. Robert Cialdini, the author of Influence, returns with Persuasion, a revolutionary way to influence and persuade. That's right, how to get others to comply with your requests. You just have to know your science. Then on Biotech Nation, Dr. Daniel Kraft, the chair of medicine at Singularity University and founder of Exponential Medicine and its popular annual fall conference each year in San Diego. He brings together a complement of people interested in the frontiers of science and the technology that can drive it. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Alvin Toffler taught us about society and the giant waves of technology that affect it. He said the first wave was agriculture, which clearly changed the nature of society. The second wave started in the 1820s with the Industrial Revolution, and massive industrialization changed how we lived individually and collectively. Then the third wave started in the 1950s, what we now might call the information age. But these enormous waves say nothing about the mini waves. It's like looking at a global weather system, but missing a tiny microclimate in a valley tucked away, by happenstance protected or unduly exposed. It could be argued that there are mini waves of technology all the time, especially now. We can see it in not just over generations or in a lifetime, but in a matter of years or even months. A technology can rise, make its impact, and then fall, replaced by another technology, and a new order takes over. Just like that. I'm thinking of the recent rise of Uber and Lyft and the like, paralyzing the traditional taxi industry. And now we're seeing pilot testing of driverless cars in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And by who? Why, Uber. There's currently a driver present, but you know technology. It always gets better, faster, and cheaper. In my mind, there are two factors here, and both are larger than Lyft and more ubiquitous than Uber. The first factor is that everybody needs a job. Everybody needs to pay the bills, to have meaningful employment, and hopefully feel safe. On the other hand, this change is brought about by technology. We as engineers work hard to replace and improve many of the activities that humans do. Well, that runs counter to everyone having a job. Think of the massive server farms large tech companies are now building in more affordable sites across the United States. They're investing billions, and there is certainly construction labor at the start. But the jobs for when they go into operation? Well, how many people do you need to run a large server farm that just keeps humming along? Relatively few. I know people who live in former coal towns, former railroad hubs, former mill towns, former anythings, that the wave of technology has passed by. They need jobs just like everybody needs jobs. And a report from the President's Council of Economic Advisors tells us that 80% of the jobs which pay $20 per hour or less can be automated. So you can't say that the White House doesn't know about this. In engineering, it ain't a problem until we say it's a problem. And the tricky truth of it is, only problems get solved. So we all need to think about this. As engineers, it never feels like we're asked to create more jobs, but we should be. And not just any jobs, meaningful jobs. We like to say that all this technology creates other jobs, but how many? And we tell students that the job that they will have 10 years from now probably doesn't exist today. What we mean is that there will be a new job for them that they can't imagine now. But in fact, we might be right. It might not exist then. I've been wondering if we can solve this, or whether it's just not possible. It's just in the nature of technology, or whether it's actually solvable. In the meantime, let's get cracking. At least for now, we've defined the problem. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Dr. Robert Cialdini, Regents Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Marketing at Arizona State University and the President and CEO of Influence at Work. Then on Biotech Nation, Dr. Daniel Kraft, the Chair of Medicine at Singularity University and the founder of Exponential Medicine and its popular annual fall conference in San Diego. In looking at his work, I realized that Dr. Robert Cialdini's research centered around the topic of what leads others to comply with your requests. I told him, I need you like I need air.
Well, I think we're all in that position. Every day we ask for things and we are asked for them. So it's wise if we understand both sides of the dimension, how to be more successful in getting people to say yes, and how to resist and reject those requests that we find unwelcome or undue.
Now, research is research, and we frequently assume ivory tower-like research, men in white coats, men or mice under microscopes. But no, for 3 years, you answered ads for sales trainee positions to find out what would be a good way to sell. What did you learn?
I learned something that surprised me. Two things, actually. One is that the great majority of influence professions, those people whose business it is to get us to say yes and whose economic livelihood depends on the success of it, used very few principles of influence, only six that I counted. One is called reciprocity. They would give us something so we would feel obligated to say yes to their requests because people say yes to those they owe. Another thing they did was to produce liking. They would give us compliments, which would cause us to like them and be more willing to say yes. A third was to describe how authorities and experts agreed with them that their product or service was the right one for us to purchase. A fourth was called social proof, the idea that if a lot of other people are saying something is good, it must be good. There was a great little study done in Beijing, China, in which restaurant owners were able to greatly increase the likelihood that patrons would select certain items by simply putting an asterisk next to those items on the menu that said, one of our most popular dishes, and each one immediately became 13 to 20% more popular. A fourth principle is the principle of scarcity. We want those things more that we can have less of. So a supermarket did a study where they went to a particular brand on their shelves, and they wrote underneath the array of products, only 3 items per customer, and sales doubled. And finally is commitment and consistency. People want to be consistent with what they have already said or done, especially in public. So, for example, at a doctor's office, at the end of an appointment, you get a card with the date and time of the next appointment written on it already. Well, that leads to a lot of people who don't show up for that appointment. But you can significantly reduce the number of no-shows if you hand the patient an empty card ask him or her to fill in the date and time, and now that person has made an active, public, personal commitment to that appointment, and you get an 18% drop in no-shows. So those were the six principles. I was surprised there were so few of them. But the other thing that surprised me was that when I looked at the most effective sales and influence practitioners, they did something that their more average counterparts didn't do. They engaged in the process of persuasion. Before they ever sent a message, they arranged for the recipients to be favorable to that message. Now, that sounds like some kind of magic, but it isn't. It's established science.
So many times in our life, we're aware of when we say yes, all of a sudden we're like, yeah, we're going to go with this. Either as you and someone else making a decision together, or you yourself suddenly realize, okay, I've made a decision. So it's almost internal. Is that privileged moment of change?
It is, but that moment occurs after the moment in which the communicator can install a sort of mindset that makes us say yes to the message that we have yet to receive. So, yeah, it is. It's scary. And I was taken aback by how unconscious this process can be when I reviewed the research literature relevant to this idea of persuasion.
Now, did you coin the term persuasion, or is this known?
I did. And I'm hoping actually to coin a term people will say to themselves, well, what's the persuasive moment here that got me to say yes?
Now, you have a lot of different ways of going about this, or different moments in time. And we're not just talking about selling something, a sales action. If you have a request, where I opened up, if you need everybody in your group to do something, if you need an approval, all of these things are moments in which you could persuade whoever you're talking to.
Exactly. Let's take the case that you mentioned of, let's say you need a job. Let's say you're interviewing for a position that you really want, and you go into the interview room. There's an evaluator sitting there, sometimes two or three. And what we're trained to say at the outset is, I'm very glad to be here, and I want to answer all of the questions you have for me. Right? That's what we typically say. I'm going to recommend something in addition. And that is to say, but before we begin, I wonder if you could answer a question for me. Why did you invite me here today?
You're cheeky. What? Really?
Yeah. What was it about my resume that attracted you to my candidacy? And what we will have done is to cause people to search into our qualifications for all of our strengths, and then to make an active personal commitment to those strengths by saying, well, here's what it was, right? I have a friend who claims that he's used this strategy to get three straight better jobs in a row. He even says that in one case, when there was a group of people interviewing him, they argued with one another about which was his greatest strength. And at the end, he got the job, because he had put them in a mindset of being focused on his positive qualities. And that steered them with that mindset through the rest of the interview.
Well, look at my reaction going, oh, that's cheeky. You know, I think a common, at least female reaction, is to say, well, you don't want to ask them for anything, such as asking them for what their opinion is. And, what, you know, it's like, it's an interesting thing. It's not something we frequently do.
No, you're right. This is not common in practice. In fact, when I was doing that research where I infiltrated various kinds of sales programs and training programs, what I found that differentiated the people at the top the top achievers is that they did do this sort of thing first. They cultivated the earth. They recognize that it doesn't matter how good the seed is you have to plant, how good your qualifications are, how great your idea is. If you don't cultivate the earth before you plant it, it doesn't bear fullest fruit.
And to do that, it sometimes takes a little bit of what I was calling sort of nerviness. Knowing what you're doing, people will be happy to do many of these things.
Yeah, you know, and some of them don't require nerviness at all. Let's say you did get that job, and now your first assignment is to develop a new plan or an initiative, and you want to get your boss's support for it. What we typically do is to develop a plan and then ask the boss for his or her opinion about the blueprint that you've laid out. That's a mistake, because if we ask for someone's opinion, what they do psychologically is to take a half step back from us, a separating step, and they go into themselves. They introspect about what their opinion is, right? If instead we change one word and we ask for our boss's advice on the plan, now he or she takes a step toward us psychologically, because when someone is asked for advice, they go into a kind of partnership, cooperating, collaborative mindset. And the research shows that the boss will now be more supportive of your plan even before encountering it because of the mindset in which he or she addresses that plan.
Now, we've got some science here for what we always say in Silicon Valley. You got a new business plan and you see a venture capitalist. If you ask for money, you'll get advice. So ask for advice so you can get the money.
You know, I love that example. And you know, there's an old adage. When we ask for advice, we're usually looking for an accomplice, right?
Ooh.
Well, here's what the new behavioral science says. If you get that advice, you usually get that accomplice.
They have a piece in it. They have a dog in that fight.
Exactly. They're
like
part
it.
Of it. Yeah.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Robert Cialdini. Dr. Cialdini is a Regents Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Marketing at Arizona State University and the President and CEO of Influence at Work. You might know him from his earlier book, Influence. He's here today with Persuasion, a revolutionary way to influence and persuade. Well, you know, I've heard about the book Influence many ways and many times. I had no idea it was written in 1984, and I really had no idea that when it first came out, it was less than a hit.
Not only was it less than a hit, my publisher at the time took back the funds that had been allotted for publicity and promotion because they said to me, that would be like throwing money down a pit. No one was interested at that time in the book. But that changed about 3 or 4 years later when suddenly sales started climbing to bestseller levels where they've stayed ever since.
Now, is that the point at which Warren Buffett put it on his best business books list?
You know, it was a little before that. What I think happened was that the times changed so that people in business especially were deciding on the basis of evidence-based choices. No longer were they satisfied with anecdotes and war stories and hunches. No, they wanted evidence. And the book Influence put into one place, one handy place, all of the evidence that behavioral science had to that point on what leads people to say yes to our requests.
Hooray for big data and big data analytics, because that's where we're going today. So that's a really good thing. But where could big data and big data analytics lead us astray when it comes to persuasion?
Some things about behavior analytics that are less than effective is when they don't recognize the need to personalize the information to the recipient. And what persuasion tells us is that we get someone's attention if we can customize the message to the circumstances of the individual involved. And if we can do that, we get their attention right away, and an aligned willingness to continue to pay attention to what we have to offer, because after all, it's self-relevant.
Now, I've been in situations where suddenly I realized I had their attention, and then I just kept talking kind of at the same level. What I was seeing from your book is that that's the point you double down. You really increase what you're saying, or you throw, I don't know how to describe it, but this, I think you see the sensibility that I'm describing here.
Yeah, the thing to do is to be sure that what you've said persuasively, you've gotten their attention to a particular concept or idea or perhaps strength of your message. And then when you present that message, you want to be sure that you take that particular concept, that particular strength, and give it the greatest emphasis within your message, because people have been readied for it. They've been sensitized for it by what you did immediately before you introduced that concept.
So you got to pay attention to yourself.
Exactly right. And this is one of the things, that a nice thing about persuasion. We can actually influence ourselves in the directions that we prefer to go. Let's say you're dealing with a problem that hasn't been, you haven't been able to resolve, and you want to take a fresh, creative approach to it. Here's what you can do to increase the likelihood that you will indeed hit upon a creative, novel solution. In thinking about it, first go to a room with a high ceiling, because research shows that people are more creative in big, expansive places. They start thinking in open, expansive ways in that kind of space. So we can persuade ourselves to move in the directions that are beneficial.
Go to the library.
Yeah. Or go out of doors, because research shows that people are more creative out there for exactly the same reason. The surrounding cues are of openness and expansiveness, which causes people to be open and expansive in the way they address a problem.
It was so interesting for me to look at organizations that I'm in or have been in terms of how other people do it. And you see it. You talk about attractors and magnetizers. Who are these people, and how do they work?
Well, you know, there are people who understand what draws our attention automatically and then what holds our attention there. Here's the one that I thought was most interesting when I started reading a lot of behavioral science research. Those authors who were writing from a research perspective for a general audience, to hold their attention, they began with a mystery story. They would begin with a puzzle, and they would tell the reader, if you pay attention to the rest of this chapter or the rest of this section of the book, you will be able to solve this mystery. And they engaged a kind of behavioral technology that's called need for closure inside all of us, a desire to get closure on the questions that we don't have answers for. But a mystery pulls people into the material as a way of solving the puzzle. It was brilliant, and I found myself in these kinds of books being pulled in and paying attention to the details of the information, sometimes the boring details, because I knew that to solve a mystery, you have to know the details of the story. And so there I was, diving deep into the otherwise pedestrian or boring details of a research project in order to be able to solve the mystery at the end. I thought that was brilliant.
It is. Now, is that the attractor?
Yes, it's something that it attracts our attention and it holds it there. It holds that attention there until we have solved the mystery. You know, I used to teach university, and I tried doing this in my classes. At the beginning of the class, I would say to my students, here's a mystery of human behavior. And I would set out some puzzling aspect of human conduct. And I would say, if you listen to the rest of this lecture, at the end, you'll be able to solve the mystery. Well, Moira, when I would do that, people would sit stock still in their seats until I had revealed the mystery. No getting ready to leave, no zipping the backpacks and folding up the laptops 5 minutes before. No, they were in their seats until I had revealed that mystery. And I remember saying to myself, Cialdini, you've stumbled onto dynamite here.
I guess nobody gets up in the middle of your lectures.
That's right. And here's what I've done, although no one has recognized it. At the beginning of every chapter, at the beginning of every major section of the books that I write, I begin with a puzzle. I want people to be magnetized onto the page. And the mystery story is a technology for doing that.
So you need to be both an attractor and a magnetizer.
For optimal impact, yes.
Now, you talk about the primacy of associations. You know, I link, therefore I think. And I always give people this advice. They come to me and they say, what graduate school should I apply to? And I first say, well, is there like the best one in the world? And they go, oh, that's too high. So, well, apply. They got to take students. You know, if you're in the game, you might get picked. You know, secondly, what are some obvious ones? You know, people say safety school. And then after that, I say, pick one with a Division I football team. They say, why is that? I said, because, you know, a large school with a Division I football team, there's going to be a lot more people out there who went to it who could possibly hire you. I've been speaking with Robert Cialdini, the author of Persuasion, a revolutionary way to influence and persuade. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, Dr. Daniel Kraft, the chair of medicine at Singularity University and the founder of Exponential Medicine. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Robert Cialdini, Regents Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Marketing at Arizona State University. You might know him from his earlier book, Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion. Now he's moved from persuasion to presuasion, a term he coined in the title of his book, Persuasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade. Now, you talk about the primacy of associations. You know, I link, therefore I think. And I always give people this advice. They come to me and they say, what graduate school should I apply to? And I first say, well, is there like the best one in the world? And they go, oh, that's too high. So, well, apply. They got to take students. You know, if you're in the game, you might get picked. You know, secondly, what are some obvious ones? You know, people say safety school. And then after that, I say, pick one with a Division I football team. They say, why is that? I said, because, you know, a large school with a Division I football team, there's going to be a lot more people out there who went to it who could possibly hire you. It's a really good thing.
That's a great point, and it has to do with what I reveal in the book Persuasion, and that is the seventh universal principle of influence, besides the six that I talked about a little earlier. It's the concept of unity, of being of a group, not just like the people in that group, but of that group. If you can arrange for people to see you that way, simply by saying, oh, really, you went to that school? I went to that school. I'm a badger, or I'm a Trojan, or I'm whatever the, you know, whatever the school mascot is. Everything becomes easier now in terms of the influence process inside the boundaries of we.
You know, it's so interesting today what our resources are with perfect strangers. I frequently take my students to a networking event and I go, do we know who's there? It may not be everybody. Who do we know? And then I say, Google them. Look on LinkedIn. Oh. Find out what school they went to or where they grew up, or find out what you can find out. So if you stumble across them face to face, you can say, I like Milwaukee too.
Right. And you know, there's a double-barreled reason for doing exactly what you suggested. If indeed you find that commonality and you reveal it to that person, he or she is going to like you more. Right? Because we like the people who are like us. But you will come to like that person more if you uncover that similarity, because we're as human as anybody else. Right? And when that person perceives that we like them, the walls of resistance come down, because we know that we will be protected inside the boundaries of we by those who share that membership. And so we're much more willing to say yes to people who have seen that we like them, not just that we have made come to like us more. It's a beautiful combination that leads to a lot of assent.
Now, I have another side to this that so many of us find ourselves in that most people we work with in the organizations that we work in, we don't get to pick who we work for. We don't get to pick who we work around or with. And it's easy to work with someone with similar notions of trust and all of the different kinds of connections that are going and flowing. What about establishing trust with someone who's untrustworthy? And of course, untrustworthy people never consider themselves untrustworthy. I mean, is it even possible?
Do you mean to establish that person's trust in you?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a beautiful little strategy that is often overlooked. When we present our case to that individual, of course, all cases have strengths and weaknesses. Typically, what we do is to present the strengths first, the most compelling arguments in favor of our position, the most positive features of our idea, that kind of thing. That goes front-loaded. We do that first. And then at the end, after we've got people leaning in our direction, we might say, but of course, there are some drawbacks associated with what I'm saying, if we say that at all. That's a mistake. Because if this person doesn't trust us, then that individual will not believe our strengths until we've demonstrated our trustworthiness. And here's what we can do. Mention a weakness or a drawback in our case early. And that person will now see us not just as knowledgeable, someone who knows the pros and the cons of the situation, but someone who's willing to describe not just the pros, but also the cons. Someone who's an honest broker of information. And now the wall comes down. And that's the time for our strongest argument. People ask me, so where should I put the strongest element of my case? And the answer is, in the moment after you've mentioned a weakness in your case, because people are listening differently now to the next thing you say. They're going to process it more deeply. They're going to believe the next thing you say more fully. And bang, that's the right place for it.
Now, besides trustworthiness, there are plenty of people who are trustworthy around you, but occasionally you run into somebody who just doesn't like you, doesn't buy your act. They could be jealous. They could be any number of things. You actually don't even know, but you know, they're just not big fans.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if that's where you do what you call the meaningful and unexpected favor. Is that where that comes in?
Yes, you can do that individual a favor that is calibrated to the current needs and circumstances of that person. Not just anything, but that gives evidence that you have understood and sympathized sufficiently with that person's situation that you're giving the perfect gift, the thing that will meet that individual's needs at that moment. That's certainly one thing you can do. Another is to give a genuine compliment. This is, I have to say, my greatest weakness in all of the process of these principles of influence. And that is, I can't tell you how many times I have heard myself say to myself, let's say in a faculty meeting or in a research meeting with my graduate students, gee, that was a smart thing that Jim just said. Or, wow, that solution that Ellen just suggested solves the problem. And I say it to myself, and I miss all of the goodwill that would go from a genuine compliment that was heartfelt. We're not talking about fabricated, counterfeited compliments. Oh, nice shirt there, Jim. No, something that's genuinely admirable about that person. Say that. Hunt for it. Find it. Say that. And we turn rivals into allies.
So the meaningful and unexpected favor becomes the meaningful and unexpected compliment.
Precisely.
It really kind of flips everything you've experienced around in so many different ways. I know sometimes people have said to me when I had a particularly challenging guest that a whole lot of people didn't like, you know, but we were going to have them on. They were valid to have them on, valid what we were talking about, important what we were talking about. And people will say, how could you have that person on? They did this or that or whatever. And I remember saying to them, well, the only way to do is to find something about them you can like and look at them the whole time liking that, and then they'll talk to you. It's like,
that's exactly right. I think that is spot on.
If you think they're going to talk to you when you're looking at them like they're the worst person in the world, you can forget it.
Yeah.
Not
gonna they're going
happen.
To see that. They're going to sense that. Yes.
Exactly. So look around that room of everybody in your department or your organization or whoever that is and find something to like, even about the ones you don't like, and keep thinking that. I think that it changes your tone, certainly, if not
right.
there.
And there's one other tactic that I think we often miss, and that is simply to point to out to people that we are in the same unit as them. We've been working with them for years in this department. I had a situation in which I called a colleague to ask for a favor, somebody who I didn't really get along with very much. And he said, "Bob, I know why you're calling, but I'm swamped right now, and I can't get you that information you need for at least a couple of weeks." But I said, "Well, you know, Tom, we've been together in the same department now for over 10 years. I really wish you could help me with this one." I didn't just say, "Well, Tom, I really wish you could help me." I said, "We've been in the same department for 10 years. I had the information that afternoon."
There you go. Wow. Okay, really quickly, where do people frequently sabotage themselves?
They sabotage themselves by thinking that to optimize the process of persuasion or influence, you have to work on the message details, the features of it, the logic of it, the clarity of it. That's not what I found. You optimize it in the moment before you send your message so that people are receptive to the message when they do encounter it.
Well, Bob, this has been terrific. Please come back. See us anytime. There's lots more to talk about, and we love having you on TechNation.
Well, I have to say I enjoyed the interview thoroughly.
My guest today is Dr. Robert Cialdini. The book is Persuasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, I speak with a person who may be familiar to you, Dr. Daniel Kraft, the chair of medicine at Singularity University. He's the founder of Exponential Medicine and its popular annual fall conference in San Diego, bringing together a complement of people interested in the frontiers of medicine and the technology that can drive it. When Daniel's here, we usually talk about the newest technology or the latest trend. But today I wanted to start by asking him about convergence. It's not just about this gadget or that tech that makes the difference. It's the fact that numerous technologies have to come together to create value.
Exactly. I mean, we look at the whole continuum of healthcare, which ranges from sort of health and wellness, keeping ourselves healthy, to early diagnosis, to more precision and personalized therapy, to clinical trials. It's not any one technology or one pill or one device that matches or meets any patient, physician, pharma person. And I think what's exciting now is we have a whole new set of tools that are coming to play that can meld into almost all those buckets. It's such an exciting age. It's still filled with some hype and buzzwords, everything from digital health and connected health and mobile health and personalized genomics. These aren't just, you know, a little wearable device or the fact that your genome can be on a disk drive, that they're starting to impact the whole clinical realm and that we're having a bit of the alignment of the incentives, which are often, as you know, sort of misaligned. I often steal the line of our friend Dr. Dean Ornish and say we don't practice evidence-based medicine, we practice reimbursement-based medicine. And that's been much more in a sick care model to treat people after they get sick. And that's often based on intermittent data and sort of a reactive mindset. But if we look at the convergence now, you know, we can empower the patient, the consumer, to track their health behaviors. Behaviors being much more impactful than our, let's say, our genetics in terms of our risk for disease. And we all know the Fitbits of the world and the Jawbones and the fact that your smartphone can track your steps. That's nice for the kind of Uber geeks who live here in Silicon Valley where we're talking. But where it gets interesting is when even the chronic disease patient can get insights not just to their steps and their sleep and their blood sugar, but what else they're doing, the sort of situational awareness, the context. And then you can go, you know, how might I use this if I'm a physician taking care of a diabetic patient or a hypertensive patient to help kind of coach them to both take their meds or to keep an eye on their blood pressure, because 99.99% of the time they're not in my clinic or in the hospital. And so it's starting to connect these dots, which are still today pretty fragmented, but it's an exciting time for convergence. AI, sensors, big data, to drones and 3D printing and low-cost genomics all starting to come together and getting reasonably fast, cheap, and available.
Well, I can imagine going into my doctor, as everyone can, except for you, who is a doctor. You're probably your own doctor, right?
I'm a doctor.
Yeah. And you're your own doctor?
Well, I still have my own at Stanford. I see them every 5 years, but when we go there, we talk about the latest technologies. And I'm always still surprised, you know, when I go back and visit Mass General, where I trained, or even Stanford, how in some ways things are still stuck in the fax machine era, and the fact you're still waiting, you know, 30 minutes for your average 12-minute doctor visit or longer, or the fact that you're still, you know, on hold and pressing number one button. So,
yes.
You know, to that point, you know, I took an Uber over here and
yeah.
We'll talk more about exponentials, but that's an example of a company that couldn't have existed 10 years ago.
Right.
And people – I like to make the joke, who's going to build the Uber of healthcare? You know, things that are transparent, easier to use, the payments are taken care of, you see where the cab is.
You expect interconnectivity.
Right. And that's starting to come to healthcare. Uber did a pilot called Uber Health. You'd press a button on the app and someone would give you a flu shot, a nurse. There's now at least 5 or 6 Ubers for healthcare, which will bring a doctor or nurse to you. And my joke is, you know, you're not sure what kind of doctor you're going to get, but you can rate them and they can rate you.
No.
Yeah, sure. But the point where some of these levels, it's not just the digital natives and Gen Xers who want this ease and transparency, because so much of healthcare isn't about the technology. It's a systems issue where things get broken and kludgy and we're spending 30% of our healthcare costs on triplicate forms and faxing things and repeating tests. So it's about putting the pieces together.
Taking that image of Mass General and the fax machine and the fact that I might find, ooh, this super new wearable that can transmit my data wirelessly. You know, you don't want to go into your doctor and say, here's what I bought and where are you going to put this? And don't you want to look at me 24/7 and tell me if something, you know, you're going to get worse than a blank stare.
Absolutely not. And in fact, there's concerns about not just the, you know, the privacy and who stores the data and who's liable for it. If I'm sending you my live EKG 24/7 and you're my cardiologist, who's liable if someone has a, you know, funny rhythm and it's not caught? So I think where this heads is to the point where the incentives for value-based care are coming. And let's just say you do have high blood pressure and diabetes. And now as your primary care doctor, I'm going to get a bonus at the end of the year if you have good blood pressure control and your blood sugars are in a good range and you're not bouncing into the emergency room every 3 hours. So I might prescribe you a wearable, but I don't want to log into the wearable or the app or some other platform. We want this to flow into my electronic medical record. And arguably, many physicians, myself included, struggle with EMRs. They don't necessarily always make care better. They're kind of more billing machines. But we're going to start to see the data flow into the EMR. When I see you, Moira, I'm going to say, wow, I can look at your blood pressure trends. It looks like you're running high every afternoon. Maybe we should up your beta blocker for your second dose. And I won't necessarily have to look at the raw data, but I can see the meta trends. And we'll be applying much more machine learning and analytics on that to ping me. I might not wait for you to call and say you have a headache or have had a worse condition, I'm going to see, boy, Moira's blood pressures are running 20 points above normal. I'm going to call you and we may then adjust your dosing. And I think when, again, those sort of incentives align, you can already buy a connected blood pressure cuff on Amazon or a Best Buy or an Apple store, but it's not yet part of your doctor's and your nurses and your healthcare system's flow, but that's starting to emerge.
That's where we're going with all this. And, you know, some of this is nomenclature because that frequently defines how we think about things. EMR, electronic medical record, that came out of, it used to be you went to the doctor's office and there was the big manila folder with some kind of color coding. I don't know what all those colors were. I never knew, whatever. And it's just jammed with paper and everything. And so that's sort of the record is there. But the whole idea that rather than this has to be brought together in some central system, why it can't all be disparate and then as needed, as wanted, can be brought together. That's a whole different design.
And brought together proactively based on your personal genomics or metabolomics or even microbiome data.
Exactly.
And to the point where, you know, no physician or even patient can mine through their entire paper or electronic record. I want to bring to the top the things that are relevant for you. And that's not just having a listing of your history and your meds. It's maybe integrating your social network data, your financial health, your mental health, which can be tracked from your smartphone today, and rising that to the top using now things like, it's often called artificial intelligence. I like to call it not AI, but IA, intelligence augmentation, augmenting the clinician, not replacing them, to make sense of now this explosion of data so that it becomes actionable at the point of care, in the patient's home, on a daily basis, where you don't need to go to the clinician for them to tell you what to do. You may be empowered to use it in smart ways. Some of these smart AI coaches are emerging. you've seen a local company maybe called Lark. It will track your steps and your sleep and give you a fun sort of chat bot and makes it engaging. Imagine that starts to manage your chronic heart disease or renal failure and makes the whole process of engaged healthcare much more palatable.
I really want to bring this all together. I was very fortunate that you invited me last year to come to Exponential Medicine, your annual forum. I really want people to hear about that. What is it? I guess it's coming up again this fall in San Diego.
Right. So I've been fortunate to chair the medicine side of Singularity University. Singularity University started 9 years ago in Silicon Valley, Mountain View. And what was fascinating was we bring all these fantastic technologists and leaders together, some in healthcare and otherwise, but everyone's interested in health and medicine from a personal perspective or otherwise. And many of the great innovations that are happening across biomedicine today are coming from folks with outside knowledge and outside mindsets. And many clinicians and researchers go to very siloed meetings, oncology meetings, pharma meetings, cardiology, what have you. So I put together now 5 years ago a program called Exponential Medicine to look at these exponential technologies, how they're coming together, what's the cutting edge, and where can they take healthcare. So a few small examples. Our smartphones are now our digital health platforms. We also have low-cost genomics. The price of sequencing has dropped from $1 million 10 years ago to about $1,000 today. We're now in the era of connected Internet of Things coming into Internet of Healthcare. There's 3D printing, which is being applied to printing everything from your braces to orthopedic casts. So what we like to do at Exponential Medicine is bring folks from pharma, device world, patients, nurses, doctors, investors, I'll mix them up, go, you know, what's the cutting edge today and what's likely to be here in 2018, 2020, and help that leverage new imagination, new cross-fertilizations. And from that, we've had lots of new companies start, new collaborations, new friendships, and that's often at the interfaces where the magic happens. You know, for example, some of the tricorder competition companies have been born there because it's an example of building a home-based diagnostic that blends things that could track your vital signs to your labs like your urine and your blood, and making that useful for triage for the patient and the caregiver and their family, as well as enabling the physician and the healthcare system.
Now it's 3 days, right? It's 2.5 days?
It's actually 3.5 days.
We're
at the beach at the beautiful San Diego-based Hotel Del Coronado, the oldest resort on the West Coast. And it's sort of a bit of an improv play. You know, I brought together you and 60 other faculty, and it's amazing how the sort of sparks fly. You might be hearing a talk about big data applied to and machine learning applied to radiology 1 minute and the future of the microbiome the next. And it's, again, where those interfaces happen that the magic happens, including having time to be on the beach and go on runs and meditate and have breakout workshops. And so a lot of the talks we've had from our past faculty are at exponentialmedicine.com. But the basic mindset there is to blend and get out of the box that normally folks are in and have them meet others from around the world. We have about half a third of the folks from different countries and cross-fertilize and ask, you know, what are the challenge areas and how might we use some of these new tools in smart new ways and not just have them gadgets on our shelves.
If you had to hope for one thing that could happen in the next year, what would that be?
I think what's starting to happen, I think what really needs to happen in the next year and few years, if we're going to really reach our potential to reshape health, diagnostics, therapy, is that a lot of these new technologies need to be part of the workflow of the clinician. Let's say it's the workaday primary care doctor. It's no good if you come to your doctor with your genome on a disk drive or all your wearable data from your sleep and your steps if they can't access it and make it useful and not be overwhelmed and have tools to make this part of their integrated electronic medical record, all the way to how they diagnose and pick the right therapy for you. So my hope in the next year is we're starting to see, you know, with Apple and Samsung and Google and these consumer companies now allowing this data to flow through the consumer platforms, the dots will start to connect and we'll start to show the value. It's still, in some cases, not always obvious that just having a smart device and a data flow and a feedback loop are going to help. But as it becomes part of the physician workflow and the incentives align to not just do more procedures and admit more patients, but to use smart technologies, I think we can really reshape healthcare and move the needle here in the United States and beyond.
So maybe just a few of you physicians step up. It's all there. You just have to do it.
Right. There's this famous quote, the future's already here, just not evenly distributed. And the quote that's attributed to Abraham Lincoln and others is, you know, we don't need to just predict the future. We can go out there and create it. And there's no better time to be an entrepreneur, a physician, a technologist applying these new mindsets to health and medicine because there's so many unmet needs across so many different spectrums.
Well, certainly something that could make changes fast is this new California Impact Challenge on precision medicine coming out of the state of California.
Yeah, we just actually did that in collaboration with Singularity University. And precision medicine is, you know, sort of on a hot button element. Given that the state of California in 2010 spent about $98 billion on just six of the most common chronic diseases, from heart disease to depression to arthritis. And the challenge is to bring folks from within biotech and medicine, some traditional folks and others, to think how could you have novel approaches leveraging exponential technologies from different realms, whether it's big data and low-cost genomics to sensors and nanotech and beyond, to foster better prevention, early detection, and better management of existing disease. And so we're hoping to foster through this incentive program, there's prizes, monetary and trips to exponential medicine, to bring new thinking to this really important area.
Well, Daniel, always a pleasure. You come back. See us anytime.
We'll do, and we'll hopefully see you back at Exponential Medicine this fall.
You bet. Dr. Daniel Kraft is the chair of medicine at Singularity University and the founder of Exponential Medicine. More information about the Exponential Medicine Conference in San Diego can be found on the web at exponentialmedicine.com. I should say at this time that the deadline for the 2016 California Impact Challenge in Precision Medicine has passed, and the submissions are now under consideration. The winner or winners will be awarded $10,000 and be a part of the Innovation Lab at the Exponential Medicine Conference in San Diego. Since the audience brings together other innovators and inventors, people from the medtech and biopharma fields, investors, and even physicians, the latter may be the greater value in the prize. Still, it struck me that the challenge was being sponsored by the state of California, presented, in fact, by several offices of the governor, whose reputation has been well-earned, harnessing the huge California state budget. With a little more investigation, I discovered that the words used to describe the goal of the Impact Challenge can impact everyone and anyone. The goal is so that California can leverage the convergence of new and exponentially growing technologies to achieve the greatest gains in our ability to foster prevention, early detection, and better management of existing disease. That's right, get there before what we think of today as healthcare is needed. It's a whole new picture of healthcare and potentially a whole new experience of treatment for those, unfortunately, touched by disease. While the submission date has passed, if you're an inventor or an innovator or an organization that's interested in stimulating change in precision medicine, simply reading the 2016 California Impact Challenge in Precision Medicine can be informative. It can be found on the web at exponentialmedicine.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.